Hello and welcome back. This is So Let It Be Written. This is part two of my conversation with experts from the JFK assassination research community, which is a loose affiliation of historians and freedom of information experts and military people who are going through all the declassified records surrounding the murder of JFK, November 22nd, 1963. So as Larry Hancock revealed in our November 22nd podcast episode, if you haven't listened to that, then you can pause this and go back and listen to that episode first, but you don't need to. But it shows a little bit of a sequence because my questions are kind of informed somewhat by what I talked to Larry about. But Larry, one of the things he talked about, which I wasn't all that aware of entirely, was the ARRB, which is the Assassination Record Review Board, which started in 1994, releasing these classified documents, this review board. The board stopped dumping these documents in 1998. So for a period of 4 years, they just were declassifying and publishing every JFK assassination record that they could get their hands on that they were able to release that weren't classified or filed under national security issues and needed to remain classified. Obviously, a lot of these records are heavily redacted. There's black ink going through it. There's names are left out, addresses, things of that nature. But even since then, more records have been released. And as they come in, new things start to come to light. So basically, at this point, if you believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone and killed JFK, then you also believe in flat Earth. You also believe the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And you believe Donald Trump was elected to take down an international sex trafficking ring. In other words, you're repelled by common sense and truth. Or you don't really care because it was 57 years ago and anybody who might have gone to jail or gotten in trouble for killing the president is either dead or about to be dead, or will be dead by the time the record gets released. So the records are still being released. They're still being examined. FOIAs are filed every day by these experts and historians. So my guest today is one of these experts. Jim DiEugenio is a historian and the author of, among other books, Destiny Betrayed, JFK, Cuba, and the Garrison Case. Now, if you're interested in buying his book, and Jim points this out on the podcast, but I want to repeat it here in the intro, if you go to Amazon to buy this book, make sure you buy the second edition of the book because it has a lot of updated information as a result of these records becoming public and accessible. He's able to piece more of the crime scene together because of these records. So I'll post links in the show notes to the book. Jim DiEugenio talks a bit about the Garrison investigation. Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney who actually brought someone to trial in the JFK murder, a businessman named Clay Shaw. My guest says Garrison was nearly there, which is remarkable considering the amount of stonewalling and botched investigation work that was done by the Warren Commission. Anyway, enjoy my conversation, please, with the great Jim DiEugenio.
Call me like a Hellcat.
We're talking to Jim DiEugenio. He's the author of, among other things, Destiny Betrayed, JFK, Cuba, and the Garrison Case. I got to tell you, I got interested in the JFK assassination when I was, I guess maybe just a freshman in college or something, even though it was a couple of years after the film. I saw the film very late after it had come out, but the JFK film with Kevin Costner, the Oliver Stone film, was really what piqued my interest about it. I never got completely bit by the bug where I joined a community or got involved or anything like that, but it always fascinated me. And particularly the end of the film when they put up a graphic saying that, you know, even the government has acknowledged at this point, this was in 1991, 1992, they acknowledged that there was a probable conspiracy involved in JFK's murder. But it's always just sort of fascinated me. I've been sort of consumed by it a little bit. And lately I've been really into it as well. And I found these old newspapers that my mother dropped off with me. She says she doesn't know where she got them. She thinks maybe her mother cut them, but I have like the original Daily News, our newspaper the day after he was killed. I have it all right in front of me. Been reading up on some of the accounts even before these podcasts. So, but I'm certainly not as invested and as delved into it as you or as Larry or other people in the community. So I just want to know how did you get involved in this community? Are you like you're a second generation investigator into this or?
Well, I would actually say that between a second and a third, okay, because I first got interested in this case in an offhand way after I read the Jim Garrison interview in Playboy many years after it was first released, okay? And that kind of picked my interest because in that interview, which I believe is in late 1967, he actually marked out an alternative theory of Kennedy's assassination, which I found to be very provocative and much more sensible than the Warren Report, all right? And so I kept this in the back of my mind, and then I moved out to California. I'm originally from Pennsylvania. I moved out to California. I went to film school out here, and my partner at this time, who I made a couple of films with in film school, said, you know, there's two ways you can get into the film industry, from the bottom up, or you go in with a really good script and you sell the script. Mm-hmm. And he said, why don't you write a script? And so I said, well, how about the Kennedy assassination? And I remember this Jim Garrison guy. So in other words, I had Oliver Stone's idea at this time, not knowing that he was interested in this subject. Mm. So he beat me to it. I wasn't going to be able to compete with him, of course. Right. And I turned my notes I had made into the first edition of Destiny Betrayed. And let me add, please, to everybody listening, don't buy that version of the book. Okay? Because as everyone knows, Stone's movie reverberated through the halls of Congress because he embarrassed the heck out of them by putting that last printed title on the screen that the House Select Committee decided Kennedy had died as a result of a probable conspiracy. And then they classified all their files on the case, which, by the way, came to 545,000 pages. Mm. All right. And so because of this, America got outraged and they began sending telegrams and letters and calling, et cetera. And the actual chairman of the House Select Committee, Congressman Stokes, saw the movie, and his daughter asked him, Dad, why did you do that? Why did you classify all those files? Mm-hmm. And so this created something called the Assassinations Record Review Board, which was in operation from 1994 to 1998 and declassified approximately 2 million pages of documents, all right? And that is what I based the second edition of Destiny Betrayed on. So that's if you really want to read a book by me, that's the one to read, the second edition. It's not okay.
Yeah, it has more updated records. It's based more on the evidence that you've gotten in your hands since then, huh?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
amazing. So that's how I got into this.
One of the things that I was fascinated about was in my conversation yesterday was that the documents, see, in my imagination, I always imagined these documents and these memos would literally say, like, subject Lee Harvey Oswald was having coffee at such and such a cafe across from, Guy Bannister. But what I was told yesterday is these documents are heavily coded. There's all sorts of code names and numbers. And sometimes you get lucky because some transcriber like hand wrote a note that actually contained a real name in there or something like that. So I always imagine the documents would be more straightforward, but they're coded. It takes a lot of time to try to decode them. No.
Let me explain there.
Okay.
The documents from the Garrison investigation, okay, which we didn't have before, are not like that, okay, because he wasn't part of the government,
right?
The documents that the CIA have, and to a lesser extent the FBI, do have what they call cryptograms in them, okay, in which they did not reveal the actual name of the subject,
right,
but the cryptogram for the subject. And then people in the research community had to do all the work to find out who is this real person
right.
in reality. And by the way, and I have to say, in large part, these people have done a really good job figuring that out, okay? As hard as it is to do, all right? But they, by and large, a lot of them were figured out, okay? Although there's probably still some that they haven't figured out. But let me say this. In my opinion, all right, the whole Kennedy case has been rearranged and redefined by the work of the Assassinations Record Review Board, which is probably why the mainstream media relatively ignored it. Okay. In every single way you can imagine, the case took large steps forward, and especially, I believe, in the investigation of the autopsy that was performed by Jeremy Gunn, who was the chief counsel of the review board, and his assistant, Douglas Horn, who was the military analyst on the board. Their investigation of what happened to Kennedy after he was killed at Bethesda, okay, in my opinion, really, really opened up the case to the point that today, saying that President Kennedy was not killed by a conspiracy is pretty much tantamount to saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, okay? Because we can prove it so many different ways now that it's utterly ridiculous. And the only reason the public doesn't know about this is because the MSM, for whatever reason, is still tied to the Warren Report. And so all they put on is people like Jerry Posner, Philip Shannon, Larry Sapato, and these other people. None of these, who none of them say anything about this new information. Let me give one example. Let me give just one example of what I mean by this and why I say what I just did and why I'm able to defend it. John Stringer, okay, who probably nobody even knows who he is. John Stringer was the official photographer for the Kennedy autopsy. Now, to show you how bad the Warren Commission was, go ahead and try and find an interview by Arlen Specter, who did the medical research for the Warren Commission. See if he interviewed Stringer. I can tell you right now, he did not, okay? All right, now let's flash forward to the ARB, who did call John Stringer as a witness to do a deposition. Now, when John Stringer came before the board, Jeremy Gunn had all the x-rays and the pictures of supposedly taken by Stringer. He did the photograph. All right, and he put them up on a board in front of the witness, okay? And he asked him, Mr. Stringer, did you take these pictures? And I want to precede this by saying, I am not exaggerating, and I'm not making this up. Stringer paused, okay? He walked towards the board, and he looked at the numbers in the lower right and the title up in the upper left. And he said, words of the effect, this is ANSCO, meaning that's a type of film that was used back then.
Okay.
He said, I didn't use ANSCO. Okay. I didn't use ANSCO. And he said, look at these numbers on the bottom here. This was done in the press pack. which is a technique you use to take pictures. Says, I didn't use press pack. Okay. And so Gunn said that Gunn pressed him. He says, well, are you ready then to say that you didn't take these pictures? And Stringer said, no, I didn't take them. not if this is press pack and this is ANSCO. I didn't take you. So then the question, and see, this is what really gets me angry as to what Arlen Specter did. Because if Arlen Specter would have done what he should have done back in 1964, and if he would have interviewed Stringer, and if he would have done a professional job, okay, then the question would have become, if you didn't take them, who did? And then, of course, the other question is, why? Okay, but see, the American public is never going to find out the answer to that question.
Right.
Because of the horrible job the Warren Commission did in a homicide investigation. And let us never forget this. Fundamentally, at the bottom of this case, it is a homicide investigation. Okay?
Yeah, and they're not, the Warren Commission are not, they're not investigating, they're not homicide detectives.
Yeah, most of them were not.
Lawyers.
Most of them are like corporate lawyers,
right?
Real estate lawyers, or yeah, things like that. They weren't criminal investigators.
Yeah. What would the autopsy have done? You're the second person I've heard now who's brought up like I've heard a lot talked about the autopsy. What would you have liked the autopsy to have revealed? What would the autopsy have told us if it had been done correctly, if it had been photographed correctly?
Let me tell you, since you asked me that question.
His brain had been located. Yeah.
In addition to what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in addition to what I just said, all right, since this was a homicide case, what was utterly necessary to have been done was what is called a dissection of the wounds in President Kennedy. What that means is a tracking of the holes in President Kennedy to find out, number one, directionality. Which way did the bullet really come in?
Wow.
And number two, did the bullet transit? Did it go all the way through the body? Well, again, this is supposed to be a homicide case. Neither one of those was done. Neither one. And by the way, although Oliver Stone caught all kinds of heck for his depiction of the autopsy in his film JFK, what he depicted really happened.
Yeah.
Somebody stopped Jim Humes, who was the lead pathologist there, okay, and said, no, you don't have to do that, when he was going to dissect the wound. Okay. Now, on top of that, of course, I think everybody knows, the Warren Report concluded that one bullet came in behind Kennedy. They called it in the back. It was really... they called it in the neck. It was really in the back. But the other fatal wound, and this was fatal, according to the Warren Commission, came in at the base of the skull, a little bit to the right.
Mm.
Well, in that case, what you do in order to dissect that wound is you do what they call a sectioning of the brain. Okay? What that means is, and there's one of two methods. You can do what they call a bread loaf section, in which you cut horizontal slices, okay, from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do what they call a pie section, okay, in which you cut diagonally, all right? Now, the reason you do that is so you can see the trajectory of the bullet through the brain, okay? Well, if you can believe it, that wasn't done either. That wasn't done either. So in other words, and by the way, I wrote the script for Oliver Stone's upcoming documentary, JFK Destiny Betrayed.
Mm.
And I was in there for many years. Henry Lee, who of course is probably one of the best criminologists there is in the entire world, okay, we asked him this question. If you do not dissect the wound, okay, in a gunshot homicide case, can you actually and accurately chart the trajectory of a bullet? And he said, extremely difficult to do it without the dissection of the wound, okay? So here, I've been talking to you for 10 minutes so far. Yeah, we have fake brain pictures, okay? No dissection of the back wound, no dissection of the skull wound. So therefore, no way you can tell what the trajectory was in this murder case. And this is not some guy, you know, like on the south side of Chicago, okay? This is the president of the United States.
Right, right. Yeah, no, you think every precaution would have been taken to make sure they dotted every I and crossed every T. Tell us about, so then tell us what about Destiny Betrayed a little bit. What do you think happened then on November 22nd?
Oh, you mean in my book?
Yeah. What do you think happened? Like, what is your overall thoughts on it? Is it
okay? In my book, and by the way, the documentary is not based upon my book. Mm-hmm. Oliver just took the title of it.
Gotcha. Okay.
We really don't deal that much with the Jim Garrison case in the film. I think it's only like maybe 15 minutes. All right. In my book, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, in that particular book, I spent over 400 pages on the new documents in New Orleans. And I tried my best to put together a scenario for what I believe happened in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a very short description, I believe that Oswald was being manipulated by people in Dallas, by people in New Orleans, okay? And they put him in this position that the actual framing device was this so-called trip to Mexico City, all right? Which got, and all this stuff got injected into the media in a remarkably short period of time. I mean, newspapers, for the only time in my life, they put out an extra edition in my hometown, Erie, Pennsylvania. And the TV news, radio news, all this stuff about Oswald in New Orleans and Oswald in Mexico City got into the mainstream media in a remarkably short period of time. So therefore, literally almost overnight, everybody assumed Oswald killed Kennedy because he was a communist, okay? All right, and so in my book, what I try and show is that A, it's very debatable, and in fact, today I don't believe it, whether or not Oswald ever went to Mexico City. Okay, if you had to ask me, if you had to put me on the witness stand, okay, and if I had to say yes or no, and there's no middle ground, I would probably say no, that Oswald didn't go to Mexico City.
Right.
And therefore, all this stuff that the CIA injected into the media, you know, was fabricated, okay? All right, and I also believe that in New Orleans, Oswald was being manipulated by certain people that Jim Garrison was on to at this time. That would mean people like David Ferry, Guy Bannister, Sergio Acacia Smith, and Clay Shaw, all right? And these people said, and this is why Oswald says, you know, I think it's on the first day, you know, when they ask him, have you been charged with the murder of the president? And he says, no, nobody told me that yet. And he goes, well, you have. Okay, and remember that look of shock on his face?
Yeah.
When he learns that he's been charged, and then as he's being carted off, he says, I'm just a patsy.
Yeah.
Okay. And he realized right then and there that he was being set up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He didn't realize, of course, until it was too late. Now, again, I'm not going to be on that long, but there's another segment to this. And I believe that is also in Dallas by three people. George De Morning Show, and Ruth and Michael Payne. Now, should I tell the your listeners who those people are? Or do you
think real quick, tell us, who's – I've heard the name George DeMorenschild.
George DeMorenschild was – well, let's put it this way. Out of nowhere, he became Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend in the Dallas-Fort Worth area when Oswald returned from the Soviet Union in 1962. But as many people have said, talk about the odd couple, okay? Because, you know, DeMorenschild was this very suave, debonair, James Bondish kind of ladies' man, you know, who was interested in petroleum engineering, you know, and, you know, was just about the complete opposite, a white Russian to be also, okay? Right. You know, so here he suddenly be this communist, you know, who has just come from back from the Soviet Union. And it was later revealed, of course, before DeMorenschild passed on, that he was told to meet Oswald by the local CIA station chief, J. Walton Moore. All right. Now, DeMorenschild, in the spring of 1963, leaves Dallas-Fort Worth. But before he leaves Dallas-Fort Worth, he arranges a gathering at which Ruth Payne is there, okay? And so then, again, out of nowhere, Ruth and Michael Payne now become the new best friends of Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald.
Yeah, they were his landlord, right? Or...
Well, let's put it this way. They were very, very friendly. And then when Oswald went to New Orleans in that summer, Ruth Payne picked up Marina Oswald, and also she had a station wagon, so she put in all of their belongings in the station wagon, drove it back to Dallas, and because Marina was pregnant at the time, Marina stayed with Ruth Payne when they returned from New Orleans, and Oswald got a room at this Beckley Street place, okay? And it was Ruth Payne who indirectly got him the job at the Texas School Book Depository after rejecting a call for a different job in a different area that would have paid him more money, all right? So in other words, what I'm saying is that I believe that Oswald was ensnared by people who he thought were his friends, okay? But they were really not his friends, all right? And then, of course, on the day of the assassination, the combination of these films of him in New Orleans with these flyers passing around in the streets of New Orleans, and then the news of him being in Mexico City, and then Ruth Payne producing all this evidence that was incriminating him coming out of her garage, that was it. Okay, that was it.
Yeah, the picture with the gun, and right, the picture holding the gun, the rifle with the...
Yeah,
the Marxist. What was, are you able to put together what Oswald thought he was there to do? Like, what was he, what did he think? What's that?
When you say there, what he was
doing? The Book Depository. Like, he takes the job at the Book Depository. Right. Presumably, he's being set up to go there so that he can take the fall. But he had to have known, he had to have been told some sort of alternative plan, no? I mean.
See, between jobs for the CIA, okay, between jobs, Oswald would go on this kind of hiatus, okay, until his next assignment would come in, all right? You know, and I think obviously his first assignment was this fake defector thing to the Soviet Union, all right? In which he was part of a program by the CIA in combination with the ONI to try and gather intelligence because we didn't have very much from what was going on inside the USSR. Now, the Russians, of course, didn't buy Oswald for 10 minutes. Okay, so when he gets there, they kick him out of Moscow, okay, yeah. And they send him to Minsk, which is about 400 miles away, and instead of Oswald spying on the Russians were spying on Oswald, right. Because they knew he was some kind of CIA flunky, okay? Yeah. So then when they realize, well, this isn't going to work, okay, they call him back to the United States, okay, and he goes to Dallas-Fort Worth, waits for his next job, which is going to be smearing the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Okay, and he starts that in Dallas-Fort Worth. He does one leafleting thing, okay? But then when he goes to New Orleans, and by the way, and I have to say this. Imagine you're back in 1963, mm-hmm. before the Civil Rights Act that Kennedy put through Congress in 63 and then was passed in 1963. Imagine you're in a southern city, okay, the Deep South. What communist in his right mind would go on a huge city street like Canal Street in New Orleans and start saying, look, we need to be fair to Castro. Okay, right. What are we doing here? Okay. Yeah. And by the way, when I talk to a former communist, okay, he said, Jim, when I saw that, I knew that Oswald was not a communist.
Yeah.
Because he never did that. That is the dumbest thing you'd ever want to do if you were a communist at that time. What we would do is we would go in at night, okay, and we would leave the literature in the foyer of an apartment house so that we would not be identified and the person picking up the literature would not embarrass himself by stopping on the street and getting something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so right then and there, I knew this guy's not a communist, yeah. Okay? All right, so that's what his other assignment is, to go to New Orleans and smear the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and that culminates, of course, in the radio debate, okay, I think this was in August, in which he's trapped by Ed Butler and Carlos Brignier, both closely tied to the CIA, mm-hmm. and they expose him on the radio debate as being a former defector to the Soviet Union.
Right.
Then Oswald gets a lot of press for this in New Orleans, and then the last thing we have him doing is going up to the Clinton-Jackson area with Sean Ferry. Yeah. Now, this is a very complicated scheme of what happened up there. Okay, and nobody can say with actual precision what really did happen. Okay, but in my opinion, and the opinion of others, Oswald thought he was doing one thing, okay, like smearing the voter registration drive core up there, okay, while the people around him were really doing something else. Okay, they were trying to get him to a position in the sanitarium up there. Okay, so if he did, then that would be the last nail on the coffin, that Oswald wasn't just a socialist, he wasn't just a neurotic guy, he was also demented, okay? And that would have been it, okay, for Oswald. Now, let me cap off, I don't know if Larry went through this with you. Very few people know this, but the House Select Committee did investigate it. Oswald, by the end of the first day, by Saturday, understood what was happening to him. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he requested to make a phone call. All right. His phone call was to a man named John Hurt on the East Coast. All right. And John Hurt had been military intelligence. All right. And he was located about 100 miles from the Nag's Head Naval Base in North Carolina, which I think is on the Outer Banks. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the places where the Navy schooled their fake defectors, part of the fake defector program. Mm-hmm. All right. So when Oswald gives this number to the secretary, there were two secretaries there that night, to place a long-distance phone call, The Secret Service guy comes over and says, don't connect the call. And so that goes into the trash. But the other secretary waited until the Secret Service guys had left and the other secretary had left. She picked it out of the trash because she was curious as to, wait a minute, why didn't they want to complete this phone call? And when they showed this to Victor Marchetti, who used to work for the CIA, and they explained the whole thing to him, they said, what do you make of this? In my opinion, Oswald was trying to get to an outside handler. And he needed instructions. What do you guys want me to do? Do you want me to deny everything? Or what? Okay. Are you going to save me at the trial? Okay. And so when he tried to do that, Marchetti said, that was it. Okay, that was it for him. And of course, the next day, Jack Ruby comes in to the Dallas headquarters with 70 cops sitting there, okay, yeah. And polishes off Oswald on national television.
Now, when it comes to Ruby, are you of the opinion that he was involved, or is there room for him to have been just legitimately a distraught Kennedy supporter who just lost his mind temporarily?
I believe for 10 seconds that Ruby was not involved.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, one of the things I did in Destiny.
I don't either, by the way, but I just had to ask.
Yeah. Okay, good, good. One of the things I did in Destiny Betrayed, and I did a lot of work on this, okay, is I thoroughly examined all the testimony, all the circumstances about that day, the day that Ruby shot Oswald, from the beginning, from the morning, until the afternoon, until the aftermath, all right? And the Warren Commission, well, this is par for the course with them. The Warren Commission misrepresented how Ruby got in to the basement. He did not come down the Main Street ramp, okay? That is just complete and utter baloney, all right? All right, and in my book, I explain why that, and the Warren Commission did not even interview the guy who's probably the best witness, okay? Because there was a policeman he understood what was gonna happen, the transfer was gonna happen.
Yeah.
He was right across the street from the Main Street ramp, leaning up against his car. And he said he knew Ruby, all right? And he was standing right there. Says, there's no way in the world Ruby came down that Main Street ramp. Mm-hmm. Okay, he did not come down the Main Street ramp. He never got to testify before the warrant. No, yeah, of course, by this time you understand why. All right, so Ruby obviously had to come in a different way. Ruby lied about this. The Dallas police lied about this. Okay, Ruby came in the back way, all right, and then the security team and the Dallas police lied about the doors being locked, all right, because the House Select Committee interviewed the custodial team, and they asked them, they said, is it possible if you did not lock this door, that you could get in from the outside? And they said, yes. Okay. So obviously Ruby came in from the back, went up the stairs. Okay. And had enough time. And by the way, if you get a chance, if you want to see the ultimate truth of what Ruby really did, okay, there's a film called Evidence of Revision on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And it's this guy who somehow collected this amazing photography, which the mainstream media does not show you whenever you see this Kennedy assassination address. It is plain as day, as anybody can see, that Ruby is hiding behind Blackie Harrison, one of the cops on the Dallas police force, before Oswald comes out. All right, anybody can see this. He's clearly hiding behind this guy. Now, the question is, why would Harrison let him hide behind? Okay. All right. And then to top it off, and let me explain how I got into this next thing I'm about to tell you. Ray Marcus, an original first-generation researcher, once called me, and he said, Jim, which version of Ruby killing Oswald do you have? I said, what do you mean, what version? And he says, do you have the one with no horns, one horn, or two horns? And I said, one horn. Okay, you got the edited one. I go, what do you mean I have the edited one? Because NBC edited that. Okay, so I'm going to send you the original.
The car horns.
So here I am. I get this thing. And I put it on. I put it in my TV. And it's the eeriest thing that I thought I couldn't be shocked anymore by this case. Right. On this original cut of the film, the horn, the first horn goes off when Oswald comes into the foyer. Okay. The second horn goes off right before Ruby springs forward to shoot him. Okay, now, let me say this. I'm not saying there was a signal system set up. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that it looks very, very weird, okay, if you watch Ruby hiding behind Harrison, then you link this up together. In other words, again, this should have all been investigated by the Warren Commission.
Right.
Right? And it was not. Right?
I wish they had... They had taken him up on his offer to, he asked Warren, right, to, and Dulles to take him out of there, out of Dallas, right, and bring him up to him, bring him up to D.C., and they refused to take him. I wish they had done that.
Said that three times.
Yeah. So then why, so I guess the question then becomes, and it sounds to me like it's some of the reading that I've done around, you know, some of your work that I've read, some of your articles I've read, it has something to do with the fact that certain people within the CIA, within the intelligence community, maybe even within our level of government, didn't feel Kennedy was being hawkish enough, were concerned that he was going to be too soft, I guess, with some of these regimes that they wanted to see toppled.
Right.
And that's why they did it.
In the film that we've been putting together, we actually had a witness, Jim Gochenour, who testified before the Church Committee, all right? And he said that he was in Milwaukee studying one time to become a teacher. And because of an assignment he did, he got to know this guy named Elmer Moore, who was in the Secret Service at the time that Kennedy was killed, all right? And he met with Moore three or four times on the phone and in person. And he found out that Moore was on the Secret Service at this time, and he had an interest in the JFK case.
Mm-hmm.
And Moore said, oh, I did a lot of work on that case. And I can tell you right now, if you put together a list of suspects, it wouldn't be the Russians. You know why? Because the Russians loved John F. Kennedy because he was selling his country out to the Soviets. The guy was a Pico. And Jim Gochenour said, he started to get rabid. Okay. I was actually kind of frightened. All right. And so I started asking some questions. I go, well, what do you base that upon? Why do you think that? Okay. And he said, at this point, he pulled out a gun and he slammed it on the table. And he said, who are you working for? I said, oh, I'm not working for anybody. I'm just a private researcher.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in the case. See, you have to understand something like that to understand the mentality of the people and the levels who were investigating these cases, all right? They despised Kennedy, right? Now, let me finish that story. Elmer Moore ended up being the chaperone for 01 on the Warren Commission. He ended up going to meetings with him, keeping his files together, okay, giving him advice. He was in the room when Ruby testified before the Warren Commission, all right? So in other words, here you have this guy who thinks that Kennedy is selling out the country to the commies, and he's the escort to the guy who's supposed to be running the investigation.
Yeah.
And we didn't discover this until the 90s.
Right.
It was all classified.
Wow. Wow. And this guy confronted you about it. He got paranoid with you?
No, Jim was just telling me about it.
Yeah.
He was telling me that it was really scary.
Yeah.
This guy. Okay.
Wow.
And to think that this guy was a part of the, and by the way, do you know what else Elmer Moore did? Elmer Moore was sent to Dallas within a week or two of the assassination, and him and Roger Warner, his partner, manipulated the testimony of the Dallas witnesses so that they would not say unequivocally that the wound in Kennedy's neck was one of entrance. Because that's what they had originally said. Right. That's what Malcolm Perry said on the day of the assassination. There's a press conference in which he said that I saw the wound on the neck and that was one of entrance. Mm. All right. Now, in addition to what I just told you about Elmer Moore and Roger Warner massaging the witness testimony, after Malcolm Perry did that press conference, which I think was about 2 o'clock when he was done, which would be about 90 minutes after the assassination in Dallas, Central Standard Time. Malcolm Perry, as he was walking from the podium, was stopped by a guy with the suit on, white shirt and tie, grabbed him by the elbow, and he said, "Don't ever say that again." Now, how do I know this? Because in this film, The Parkland Doctors, Dr. McClelland, who worked at Parkland Hospital and who was actually in the emergency room along with Perry, okay, he saw that happen. Now, I don't have to tell you what that means, because I think, again, any homicide investigator who hears something like that would come to the conclusion that, wait a minute, in 90 minutes, they knew what the cover story was going to be? That's amazing. That is amazing that it'd be clamped on that fast.
Yeah. And
to me, again, if you're investigating a homicide, that has to indicate it was an inside job. You know?
I remember reading about that one of the things that was fascinating is how quickly they were able to turn around such a comprehensive biography of Oswald, you know.
The
media to take and run in their papers.
Yeah, within 2 or 3 hours, you have this whole thing about Oswald
getting
busted out over the wire.
Yeah.
And people accepting it.
Yeah. Do you think that all these strands of conspiracies that you hear about it, like the mafia, cancer researchers, communists, anti-communists, I've heard arguments that it was communists who did it, and then also anti-communist murder, the CIA, the Dallas political machine, pro-Vietnam hawks at the cabinet level. Does that all hurt the process of getting to the truth, or do you think that because there were a couple of communities that were involved in this, that inevitably you have to look at the whole fabric? I don't know if I'm answering that question properly, but like there seems to be a lot of different people who could have been invested in killing Kennedy. Does it help or hurt the process of trying to figure out what happened? Or is it good to maybe investigate any and all angles? Because I've heard a very strong, Lamar Waldron has a very strong mafia case in his book, that it was the mob, that it was...
I reviewed both of Lamar Waldron's books.
Yeah.
Okay. Legacy of Secrecy, and Ultimate Sacrifice.
Yeah.
The first review was about 15 pages long. The second review was about 20 pages long.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time and a lot of effort showing why it's so flawed. Okay. Now, am I saying that the mafia was not involved? No, I'm not saying it wasn't involved. But what I'm saying is, I don't believe they were involved at the planning stage. Okay. I believe they were called in to get Ruby, all right, to go in and to polish off Oswald. All right. Okay. Now, if you ask me who was really involved at the planning stage, I would have to say it was probably the CIA and the Pentagon. Okay. Yeah. Because now, why do I say that? The short answer is, I believe that Oswald was working for the Central Intelligence Agency as an agent provocateur. All right. Mm-hmm. And then that's how they manipulated him into being the position that he was. Then I believe that they had to have people in the autopsy room that night, to, as I started the show with, explaining what really happened, you know, to disguise the true circumstances of what really happened to Kennedy. There, I believe, and this is something I didn't mention, I think most of us know, you probably know, Humes burned the first draft and the notes from the autopsy.
Right, yeah.
And should I explain that? I mean, your listeners?
Yeah.
Okay. James Humes was the lead pathologist, assisted by Thornton Boswell and Pierre Fink. All right. Humes was supposed to be the guy who wrote the autopsy based on notes, okay, from not just him, but the other two autopsists. Well, Humes, I can hardly stop laughing when I say this, it's so stupid. Humes burned his notes. Fink's notes were stolen, okay? All right, and then Humes burned the first draft of the autopsy report, all right? Now, there are some people like David Mantic, who's very good on the medical evidence, mm-hmm. all right, and Doug Horn, who worked for the ARB, that says they also disposed of the second draft of the autopsy report that never got transferred to the archives, all right? And there's evidence for that. So what we have is essentially the third draft of the autopsy report. Okay, now that evening, really when you're doing an autopsy, what you need are the pathologists and their assistants in the room. Mm-hmm. Okay. What were 40 top brass military guys doing there? Mm-hmm. What were they doing there? There were the official count is there were 33. Wow. But Siebert and O'Neill, the two FBI guys who put that list together, said not everybody signed. So it was probably more like 40. What were they doing there? What was Curtis LeMay doing there? What on earth would Curtis LeMay, should I explain that?
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that name. Who's okay. Curtis LeMay?
Curtis LeMay was the Air Force Chief of Staff during the Kennedy years, all right? He strongly opposed what Kennedy did during the missile crisis, mm-hmm. all right, which is going for the quarantine of the island, the blockade. And LeMay essentially told Kennedy, what you're doing is what the Allies did to Hitler at Munich. Mm-hmm. About the worst possible thing you could say, you know, at that particular time.
Yeah.
Right. And so he also wanted heavier bombing of Vietnam, all right, et cetera, all right, which Kennedy opposed. On the day of the assassination, there's what we have, the Air Force One tape, okay, in which captures communications going from Washington to the plane as it's coming in to the Capitol that night. The ARB tried to find the most coolest tape of that that they could.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They said, well, this is it. It turned out that wasn't it. Years later, in private hands, surfaced a fuller transcription and a fuller tape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was cut out? Curtis LeMay was flying into Washington from either Canada or Michigan. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be kept a secret. And his first assistant, a guy named Dudman, didn't even know until LeMay was in the air. Okay. And he's trying to reach LeMay on the Air Force One tape, but LeMay doesn't reply.
Mm-hmm.
Then when LeMay lands in Washington, he disobeys orders. Okay. And instead of landing at Andrews Air Force Base, he lands at National Air Force Base. Okay. Now, let me ask this question. Why would he disobey orders and land at the wrong airport? Well, maybe because there were tons of media at Andrews and they would have recorded him landing there and they would have said, there's Curtis LeMay. All right.
Yeah. All right?
Now, we only discovered this log of him landing there. The ARB discovered it. They did an extensive search of all the airport of who came in that night. And it was a miracle they recovered this. All right. Then, during the actual autopsy, there's a guy smoking in the gallery. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And Humes tells this guy, he's one of the scrubs there, Paul O'Connor, tell that gentleman in the back over there to please put out that cigar. All right.
Right.
O'Connor walks over to the end of the gallery. He takes a look at this guy, turns around, comes back and tells Humes, Dr. Humes, that's Curtis LeMay. I can't tell him to do that.
Yeah.
So now again, here's my question. If this was a real homicide investigation, you'd have called in Curtis LeMay and asked him these questions.
Right.
Why were you flying into Washington on the day of the assassination?
Right.
Why did you not respond to your first assistant when he tried to talk to you on the Air Force One tape? Why did you land at the wrong airport when you were ordered to land at Andrews instead of, and you went to National?
Yeah.
Were you in the room smoking a cigar during the autopsy?
Yes.
See, but because the Warren Commission was such a horrendous investigation, you know, we can only ask those questions now.
Yeah. What do you think of the what have you found about, because this is the first time I heard about this, was that there was an attempt on Kennedy in Chicago that kind of got foiled, and that there was another attempt in Tampa. Is there any truth to that, or?
Yes, there is.
Oh.
We talk about it in the film.
Okay.
We talk about it in the film. Now, the Chicago one is more filled out. We have more information on that one because a very famous author wrote about this in the Chicago Independent, okay? And he did a very long series of, I would say, is about, that was a tabloid. I'd say it's about 10 tabloid pages long.
Mm.
A lot of interviews, okay, about it. And so people picked up on that, all right? And Jim Douglas wrote about it in his book, his best-selling book, JFK and the Unspeakable, all right? Now, what's so important about that is that how it resembles the Dallas plot.
Right.
In different ways. Okay, for instance, in Chicago, the limousine was coming off an exit, making a right turn in front of a tall building.
Right.
Okay. And the guy who they think was set up in Chicago, Belay, okay, to take the rap, okay, he was in that building at the time. And there were, according to the reports that we've seen, there were four Cubans there in Chicago at that time with rifles. And it was all covered up afterwards. Now, I believe that if it had not been covered up afterwards, and if those reports had been forwarded to the Secret Service in Dallas, it would probably prevent the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yeah, because at the very least, they would have covered his car or changed the route, right?
Okay. Now, I think the Tampa one, a very interesting guy named Gilberto Lopez.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's interesting about him is he was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wild coincidence that this guy's a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
Yeah. And the guy in Chicago had a lot of weird similarities to Oswald. Wasn't he also Marine? And yeah.
Right. Okay. So Lopez then goes to Dallas on the day of the assassination. Then he goes to Mexico the day after, and he flies to Cuba, get this, on a plane where he was the only customer.
Yeah.
So, again, you have to laugh. You know, the Warren Commission didn't find any of this interesting.
Right.
They didn't think any of this was worth following up.
Yeah.
Because you won't find any of this in the Warren Report.
Right. Yeah, that blew me away when I read about that in Waldron's book about Chicago and about Tampa, because I was like, I never even heard that there were I started to look in the Chicago Tribune archives to see if there was even a mention of it, because they picked up two guys, right? They saw two guys in the street that had rifles in their cars, but then they cut them loose.
Right.
And they never were able to, I don't know what happened. They never got their names or something. I don't know I forget what the particulars of it were, but it kind of just fizzled out and nobody did any time or anything but that was, yeah, I mean, that certainly wasn't anywhere in the war. There was a lot, there's a lot missing from the Warren report. It just, you know.
Well, wait a minute. I'd say it's more than that. Okay. Did we get disconnected?
No. Oh,
okay, fine. All right. There's a lot more than that. You know, you could, what I would say is that you could probably, in my opinion, you could take all the relevant information that's in the Warren Commission report, which is about 888 pages.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can condense it into probably about 200 pages for all the relevant information that's in there.
Yeah.
And then if you added in everything else that we've discovered, you would probably come into two volumes of 800 pages apiece and be a completely different report on Kennedy's assassination. Yeah. That's how important declassifying those files was,
right?
Okay, when Oliver Stone's film came out, you know, and the bizarre thing, of course, is that Oliver Stone took such a hazing, okay, when that movie came out.
Yeah, yeah. And,
you know, you looking back, you know, it's almost like, how dare you tell the truth, or at least try to tell the truth about President Kennedy's assassination when we've been spending 30 years covering it up.
Right.
You know, because, you know, the New York Times, you know what they did, don't they? Don't you? On the third day after Ruby killed Oswald, November the 25th, there's a famous headline in the New York Times in which they refer to Oswald as, quote, President's assassin.
Mm.
It wasn't alleged assassin.
Right.
It wasn't assumed assassin. It wasn't charged assassin. It was Kennedy's assassin.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who never had a lawyer, who always denied that he committed the crime,
mm-hmm.
all right? And they now call him President Kennedy's assassin on November the 25th.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the newspaper of record in the United States.
They had it all.
All right. And then, of course, I don't have to tell you, you probably know this, Mark Lane wanted to represent Oswald during the Warren Commission hearings. And J. Lee Rankin, the chief counsel, sent him a letter back saying, we're sorry, but we have too many secret documents that we can't let a public person learn about.
Yeah.
So we have to deny your request. Then, of course, you have Earl Warren saying to the reporters very early that you guys might never get to see in your lifetime the documents that we're going to look at. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, and of course, the Warren Commission hearings were closed to the public. Right? The only two Warren Commission hearings that were open were when Mark Lane testified, because he insisted that they be open. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in essence, the Warren Commission proceedings were in secret.
Right.
And the problem with that, of course, is that so many witnesses, when they finally saw their testimony in print, said, wait a minute, that isn't what I said.
Right, right.
And this included not just the Warren Commission testimony, but the FBI reports. There were even FBI reports when witnesses finally saw, wait a minute, I didn't say that. Okay, this is the wages of secrecy. Okay, when you have this kind of ultra secret government that we have, this is the price you pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, you lose democracy.
Well, and they gaslight you too, because they tell you that it's in the interest of national security that you don't know these things.
Right.
Which is a very convenient, you know, I know I was in journalism for a number of years, and I know we would take out Freedom of Information Act information on people. And a lot of times we would get a lot of heavily redacted documents because they would use like a trade secrets excuse. Cause that's one thing, you know, which understandably, you know, a company doesn't want to reveal any trade secrets, but they would call everything a trade secret, you know? And it sounds like that's kind of what was happening in a lot of cases with this, was that these records were being suppressed because of national security. You can call anything there. You can justify anything as national security.
I used to do a lecture on this, where I would show the document as it was originally released, then show that it was classified due to national security. Mm-hmm. Then I would do this about 8 times. I would show a document, then the unredacted portion, and then I would finally ask, now let me ask the audience, did anything I show you tonight endanger national security? Okay.
Mm.
Did anything I revealed to you tonight, did this endanger the security of our country?
Right.
And I would just say, no, not at our agency. What it did do was endanger the truth about what happened to President Kennedy. Okay, that's what it really did. It helped cover up the truth and the facts of this case. That's what it was for. I'll give you another example. John Tonheim was the chairman of the review board. He's a judge over in Minnesota. He said that at their first meeting with the CIA, they put up a document in unredacted form, which they were absolutely certain there could be no objections to declassifying. They put it on the screen, and the CIA representative there was right there. And Tonheim turns to the guy, and he says, what could you possibly object to in declassifying that document?
Mm-hmm.
And the guy says, I don't know, but give me a couple of minutes. I'll think of something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Oh. And see, that's the attitude these guys have.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're above the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the FBI, the first meeting with the FBI, okay, the lawyer for the ARB explained what they were doing, and that they had now had the sanction to release all of these documents, and the FBI or whatever agency the document came from they have to explain why they should not. Because in a Freedom of Information Act, which was a law before the ARB, okay, you didn't see the document and you had to make the case for it being declassified. Well, now the burden of proof was reversed. We got the document. You now have to make the case of why we should keep it secret. And so the guy, the FBI guy there, who was the representative, turned to the FBI lawyer and he says, can they really do that? And the lawyer goes, yeah, that's what this law now says.
That's the problem.
And so that's what the game is going to be for the next 4 years.
Is there a document out there or that you think is out there that you would love to get your hands on? Like anything that you're really like licking your chops to get your hands on?
Well, I don't know if you know this. I don't know if Larry told you. There's still 15,400 pages of documents.
Right.
That are still being withheld. Mm. All right. Either in whole or in part. Now, the ARB closed shop in 1998,
right,
which is, as anybody can tell you, 22 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there was a clause in the ARB law that said no matter what, everything has to be declassified 2017. So what does Trump do? Trump tweets about a week before the 2017 date that I'm looking forward is seeing the last of the JFK documents finally declassified. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens the day before they're supposed to be declassified? The FBI and the CIA demand this emergency meeting with Trump. And what does he do? Like everybody else, he now says, all right, we're going to have a 6-month extension.
Mm.
So what happens at the end of the 6 months? He now says, now we're going to have a 3-year extension.
I did not know that. That's good. Wow.
Now, we have to wait till 2021.
Okay.
Which will be 58 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Past the Kennedy assassination. To see the final documents that are being withheld. Now, you asked me, I would like to see the file on George Ioannidis finally released. George Ioannidis was a guy who was a CIA PSYOP specialist. He was called out of retirement when the House Select Committee on Assassinations started getting access to CIA documents.
Mm.
And there was a deal between the House Select Committee and the CIA that no one who was operative at the time of the Kennedy assassination, would be placed in a liaison situation with their investigator, okay? So when the House Select Committee chairman cleared Ioannidis, Ioannidis said that, no, I was not operative at the time of the Kennedy assassination, all right, in the United States. And the guy believed him. It later turned out that Ioannidis was one of the biggest obstructors to the investigation of the Kennedy assassination, all right? They started now getting files that were either redacted, non-responsive, or was not the full file. Something that didn't happen before. It later turns out that not only did Ioannidis lie, he actually was an operator at the time of the Kennedy assassination.
Mm.
He was the CIA liaison to the DRE. The DRE, the Student Democratic Agency, was in direct contact with Oswald in New Orleans that summer. People like Carlos Bringier, okay, worked with the DRE. The DRE put out the first broadsheet within 24 hours of the Kennedy assassination, saying that Oswald killed Kennedy for Castro, all right?
Mm-hmm.
It was Bringier who was in that debate with Oswald.
Oh.
That then gets out on TV and the radio, all right? So here's George Ioannidis paying these guys. He was actually paying them thousands of dollars a month to do this stuff. And he tells HSO, no, I wasn't operative at that time. Yeah. No. All right. And so I would like to, and they've hit his file. Okay. Jeff Morley, a journalist, sued the CIA to get the file on Ioannidis, and he was never able to get it. And do you know why? Who obstructed him? Rep Kavanaugh. Rep Kavanaugh, when he was on the appeals court, filed the dissenting vote that not only should the CIA not turn over that file, but also that Morley was not entitled to attorney's fees, even though he had gotten some files released and even though he had publicized those files. The rule before Brett Kavanaugh got in that appeals court was that if the file was released were of such interest as to be published, then the attorney got the lawyer's fees for arguing.
Right.
Okay. Well, Brett Kavanaugh voted against Morley in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, Trump appointed him to the Supreme Court.
Right.
You can't make this stuff up.
I'm just amazed.
You could never make this stuff up.
No, okay. No, nobody would believe it, you know?
Come on.
I'm just amazed that so many people, that there are people out there who still think that Oswald just was a lone nut, acted alone, and did this, you know?
Why are there still 15,000 pages being hidden?
Exactly. if this is such a slam dunk case, it just the fact alone that there's all this documentation just tells me there's more to it than that, you know?
Yeah.
I might as well ask you too, because I want to just, I think I'm going to close with this question, if you don't mind. I asked Larry this, so I think it's only fair I ask you as well. We're probably well past the time when anybody is going to be brought to justice for this. So my question, I guess, is that why does the community, the research community, bother continue to, is it just a hobby, or is it, what is the value of finding this out, in your opinion?
In my opinion, I believe that the assassination of President Kennedy was a milestone in American history. And this is one of the things I've written about of late. In fact, I spent the last 7 years investigating all the things that changed in foreign policy, you know, after Kennedy was killed. Because up until me in 2013, almost every Kennedy assassination book, all they did was mention Cuba and Vietnam.
Right.
And you would think that Kennedy really didn't have any other foreign policy, any other place in the world. That was it. It was all, you know, he spent 500 days on Cuba, 500 days on Vietnam, and that's all he did. Mm. Well, I found out the hard way that that wasn't the truth. That Kennedy's foreign policy was very widespread in very key situations throughout the globe. Mm. For example, Congo. For example, Indonesia. For example, Dominican Republic. For example, the Middle East. All right. And in all those situations, okay, Kennedy was changing what came before him, which of course was John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower. In every single one of those situations and more, Kennedy attempted to change the policy that existed before him, and in a radical kind of a way. All right. It wasn't just at the fringes. All right. And then in every one of those situations and more, Johnson changed what Kennedy was doing and went back to more or less what Dulles and Eisenhower were doing. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to name two examples to say that when you change presidents, you change policy. This is what happened in Vietnam and Indonesia. Okay. In other words, the eventual death of 6.5 million people, I do not believe would have happened if Kennedy would have stayed president. Now, how do I get that figure? Because the latest figures I looked up on this was that approximately 4 million people died, most of them civilians, as a result of the Vietnam War. The estimates the Pentagon put out after the war were complete and utter baloney. Okay, I looked at a survey where the guys actually went to Vietnam, sat down in the people's homes, asked them, not only did you suffer any fatalities during the war, but after the war, did anybody step on a landmine and lose their life that way? And they came up with a 3.8 million figure. Then, of course, we know what happened when Nixon started spreading the war into Cambodia. That caused the collapse of the Sihanouk regime, the collapse of the Lon Nol regime, the rise of the military dictatorship, and the Khmer Rouge took over. And that was another 2 million people. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. Then in Indonesia, once Kennedy was assassinated, Kennedy championed Sukarno in Indonesia. All right? Once Kennedy was killed, Johnson changed policies in a matter of weeks, and the CIA went to work, you know, finding people who wanted to play Sukarno. They came up with this Suharto guy, and one of the most horrible genocides in modern history took place against the Communist Party, okay, in Indonesia. So that's how I get that figure. I didn't just grab it out of thin air.
Sure.
That's how I got the figure. So that I believe the assassination of President Kennedy was a milestone, okay, in American history, which this country never recovered from. And there's a second reason. I believe that because the Warren Commission let off the true perpetrators in that assassination, that encouraged the assassinations of Malcolm X, King, and Bobby Kennedy. And if you lived through that era, as I did, I don't know how old you are.
No, okay. Yeah, I was born in 75, so yeah. I
didn't. Okay. After 1968, this was a different America. Okay. You know, and I lived through the era when those guys were alive, and I know how different it was. Okay. After they were killed, everything changed. Okay. We would have, in my opinion, Richard Nixon would not have become president. Okay. And then, of course, we had Gerry Ford. And what very few people know is it was under Gerry Ford that the whole neocon foreign policy apparatus was assembled. And that's because that Ford brought in Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
Those two guys made a power play because they thought, and I'm not kidding, they thought Kissinger was too liberal. Scary. I don't know what will.
Jesus.
Yeah. They thought Kissinger was too liberal, especially with the Soviets.
Yeah, yeah.
So they actually now began to outright wing Kissinger and the CIA, and they came up with this whole neocon foreign policy.
Yeah.
And then that was the absolute burial of any kind of any remnant that was maybe still left over from what Kennedy had tried to do. That was it. And that just buried it.
Yeah, and if you want to kick it further down the road, I mean, Cheney is the architect, really, I think, of what happened in the Middle East in 2000, 2001, you know, the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why I still study this, because I still think it's important. On my website, kennedysandking.com, I have an essay on Kennedy's Middle East policy, because Kennedy, unlike Eisenhower, unlike Johnson, unlike Nixon, actually tried to form a relationship with Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, who, in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of other people, was really the last great Arab leader in the Middle East, who was not one of these guys, you know, like MBS in Saudi Arabia with the hijab and the turban and all that. He dressed in a suit and a tie, and he wanted to modernize Egypt. Okay, he became a great hero when he nationalized the Suez Canal, and he was then attacked by England, France, and Israel. Okay, and Kennedy recognized that this is a guy I can deal with. This is a guy who's not a relic of the past, okay? Mm-hmm. Who's not a fanatic, who's not a feudalist, who wants to modernize his country, okay? I can use this guy as a way to reach out to the moderate elements, you know, in the Middle East, okay? You know, so that's another example.
Mm-hmm. All right?
That's why I think, and again, let me add one last thing.
Sure.
As much as there was a giant cover-up about the murder of President Kennedy, and we can, I've been talking about that all night.
Mm-hmm.
There was an equal, and I believe more extensive cover-up about who he really was.
Mm.
Because when you put those two together, okay,
yeah,
you found out why he was killed.
Right.
Not just how, but the why.
But the why, right. That's okay. Important. Mm. This has been great. Jim, I appreciate you talking to me and taking this time. This has been really cool. I've been getting so much fascinating information the past couple of days that, you know, there's a lot to chew. There's even names I'm typing down because I want to look a little bit deeper into this. You're not out of the game, right? You're still looking at documents. Like Larry said, he's kind of retired. He's done with it. But
he's saying he's retired now?
Yeah, that's what he says. He says he's done. I don't know. Says he's out of the game.
Yeah. I'm still writing, I'm still reading, you know, and so I don't see any in the near future where I'm going to retire and start playing golf.
Yeah. Are you on Twitter, Facebook, anything like that? Or how can people reach you? YouTube?
I'm on Facebook.
Okay.
I have my website, kennedysandking.com. And when I'm on Twitter and Facebook, I do post some of my articles, when the time is right. Okay, but I'm also very interested, of course, in the modern world. And so I comment on those things also.
Gotcha. Thank you for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right.
My pleasure.
Talk soon.